Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. This is episode number 453. And if you are hearing this as it is released, it is a Friday, which we don't normally release episodes on Fridays, but we did last week, actually, and we are again this week. It's a bonus episode with some timely topics. Brandon Maddox from Silencer Central joins us today to answer your questions about silencers, suppressors, the ATF, and what is going on in that world right now. Brandon reached out about getting back on the podcast. It had been a couple years since we previously had him on the show, and I thought it would be a great opportunity to speak with essentially an industry insider that knows all of the ins and outs of this world. And there's been a lot going on in this world. There's been a lot of changes in the past 2 years, but even recently, within the last 2 months, there's been a lot of changes, some massive changes in suppressor approval times, and a whole lot more. So we get into all of that today. In this entire episode, we focus strictly on answering your listener questions. So thank you for submitting those, and thanks to Brandon for joining us to answer those questions. As always, there's links in the show description where you can learn a lot more. And if you have any future questions for us, you can always send an email to podcast@exomountgear.com. But right now, let's dive straight into this conversation with Brandon from Silencer Central. Well, Brandon, welcome back to the podcast. I'm excited to chat with you again today. Just before we hopped on here this morning, I looked to see when you were on last. That was episode number 333, and it was almost 2 years ago to the day. So I'm curious to start here before we get into a bunch of listener questions. In the 2 years since that podcast, I feel like Silencer Central, I've seen you guys more and more and more. I'm sure there's been a ton of growth. Whether it's specifically to do with Silencer Central or just kind of the ATF, the industry, anything to do with silencers or suppressors, if I ask you what's changed the most in the last 2 years, what comes to mind?
I would say our ability to communicate that we could ship a suppressor to anyone's front door in 42 states, every state where they're legal. That's always been the challenge, right? I always say, if I can get on an airplane and you shoot a firearm and I can get about 5 minutes with you, you're going to want to get a suppressor.
Yeah.
But just getting in front of people, the biggest apprehension we find is the paperwork. People don't want to deal with it. So once you can convince them that we've got that handled and almost 20 years doing it, then their mind opens up to the possibility, and then, kind of walk them through. We let you pay while you wait and all that kind of stuff. So it's attractive. But yeah, I would say the biggest thing is just getting the message out. If you look, the ATF's number of approvals have gone, our number of applications they process annually continues to go up each year. So the market has grown. But I think also it's just a referral thing too, right? Your buddy's got one. You're like, well, it's kind of cool. I think I need one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've been shooting them for hunting for many years now, and just us talking about them, we get so many questions. And I can just see the interest continue to grow and grow and grow, which is cool. In terms of questions, we reached out on social media and to the listeners of the podcast just to see what questions they had when we said we were going to get you back on the show. And there was so many good questions, many aligned with topics I had in mind. Some were totally different. I essentially scrapped any outline I had and just wanted to answer as many listener submitted questions as possible. So that's what we're going to do. I did try to somewhat categorize them, so we'll get to that. And then also, I mentioned you on the podcast before. For listeners, if you want to get into the nitty gritty of who you are, Brandon, the services offered through Silencer Central, and a whole lot more, we'll leave links to that previous show, and then also links to all the resources for your website, which explains the process. But yeah, I want to spend the time today answering listener questions, because that's what's most valuable to the listener.
Yeah, no, I think my team saw that too on social media. They're like, that's a great idea, because those people that ask that question are going to probably tune in and want to hear the answer. So that's great.
Yeah, for sure. So let's start here and kind of chat about approval times a bit. First of all, what are you seeing for current approval times? There's been some changes with the ATF going to the e-file. There was, hopes that that would reduce things. That's been a while. It reduced it for a little bit, and then they were long again. And then just even here recently, as we record this in March, there's been some crazy changes and really fast approvals that are taking just days. So I know that there's kind of a lot going on, but fill us in on what you can let us know about, because there's still some variability in lead times, but what are you seeing?
Yeah, good question. So we had a call Friday with ATF. It was actually a town hall meeting. It was open for dealers. I think about 300 dealers signed in, which surprised me because there's about 20,000 dealers that can sell suppressors. So only, a small segment tuned in. And then towards the end, I think about half of the people were on there. But we learned a couple things. What we learned is some things I knew, but I see on social media the question is, how do you go from, typically 9 months to a year to 3 days? It just doesn't make sense. And I agree, that's kind of where my brain was at. If someone asked me what I think's changed, I think it is the personnel at ATF that are now in charge of the process. I think that they're continuing to hire more people, but I don't think that's 100% it. I think it's just putting people in place that are probably in a better position to make changes and know what changes to make to have that positive effect. So basically what ATF told us on Friday was that they're going to go to they're transitioning towards what they're kind of calling real-time background checks. Typically, they would just kind of let you sit in the queue right before they were ready to approve it. They would do a background check, and as long as you passed, then they would approve it. But now they're doing the background checks instantly, and if people are getting through the background check quickly, then they're automatically approving those. So that's a big change, a really, really big change. So what I know from my history and what they went over to is that 70% of people, when you do a background check, instantly get approved. So it's the same background check you get when you buy a firearm in a local gun store. 70% of people get approved. 30% go to what they call further review. And that means they've probably been arrested before and they need to try to figure out how that arrest ended, or there's a felon with the same similar name in the same state. So if they're, if you're John Smith in Virginia, there's a lot of John Smith in Virginia. So they're gonna have to manually review it. And that's where it adds time to the end. They also confirmed that they're going to start doing batch processing. So, if you have numerous applications that you've put in over the last 6 months, when they go to approve one of them, they'll batch all of them together and approve it all at once. And one reason is just to touch it once. The other reason is they have to pay the FBI for every background check done. So, it just makes it more efficient for them to touch it once, which makes sense. And they're going to do that on trust as well. So what we're seeing initially, sort of in the marketplace, if you will, from social media and our own experiences, you are seeing quicker turnarounds overall. Every day when my team updates me on the approval times, that number continues to drop significantly, because we look at it as an average of, I think yesterday we had 600 approvals and the average time was like 160 days. So every day we see that drop by 5 or 10 days, which is a good trend. I think that right now it's sort of an anomaly that people are getting the quick approvals, but their goal is they're putting, processes in place to make that more of a sort of a common occurrence instead of a rarity. They also are going to batch the trust, and they're also working on right now. They said why you see individuals approved a little bit quicker is they're getting the people up to speed who read the trust. So the people that read the trust and approve those, they're getting them up to speed. So they're hoping in the next couple of weeks to be in the same place where they're approving those quickly to the trust. The problem with the trust and what we do at Silencer Central is we typically just put one person on the trust and it just makes that simpler for the reviewers. And then it's just one person having a background check. And they continue to say that if you have multiple people on a trust, that's what's going to slow it down and add the time to it. So we like that language that, typically we only put one person on the trust because you can add anyone to the trust later with a stroke of a pen. But it's positive that the lead times are going down. They didn't really allude to this, but what they've always seen is as the time decreases to buy one, typically the volume increases and then it just plateaus out where it ends up being behind again. But they didn't mention that. I don't think they see that as big of a problem since they have new processes in place. So Again, it looks positive. I've been predicting for a long time that this would eventually happen. The problem is my crystal ball just didn't tell me when, but I think they've got the right people in place. I like both the guys that I see in charge now. I don't know if they would want me to say this, but they're gun guys, and I think that to have the number three guy at ATF and the person who's currently acting over the National Firearms Branch, for them to be gun people and silencer friendly, at least in my experience with them, I think that's a positive for the industry and for us.
Yeah, that's huge. I could imagine that, as you said, when people see lead times drop, it's going to create a lot more interest and a lot more demand. And hopefully it's the case where these processes are more efficient and more instant, and the demand doesn't then create the backlog. But the idea of being able to purchase a suppressor without an extended wait is going to entice a lot of people. That's for sure.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're calling people now saying, hey, you got approved in 2 months. You were going to pay monthly, but do you want to pay it off and get it shipped? Or you want us to just let you keep paying and then we'll ship it when you're done paying? And 100% of people are like, no, I'll pay it off. I want it now.
Yeah, for sure. So we had a question that said, why has the timeline for individual submissions been reduced versus trusts? And you mentioned that in there, but just to clarify, it is a bit of a different process. Things read a bit differently, and it sounds like they're getting some of the staff up to date, and hopefully the lead time for trusts will also be dropping.
Yeah, and what I've been working with ATF on is that we use the same trust. So our trust has been vetted in all 42 states. So it's lawful in each state. And so what I've been talking to them about is, hey, why read my trust every time? Because, we're using the same trust for our customers each time. Is there a way that we can, designate that for you? I mean, some people will bring a trust to us that they bought somewhere else, and that's fine. But what, I'm trying to find a way to let ATF know that, hey, this is our standard trust. Don't waste time reading it. But I think that the big take home is that trusts that have four or five people on them, the ATF example they used on Friday is, you got some people with 10 or 12 on there, then that just creates a problem because again, 70% of those people that you have on that trust are going to get approved instantly. The other 30% are going to have to go to a manual review, which just adds months to the background check. And then also, they're having to read the trust to make sure that you didn't slip something in there where the person could use a silencer and then didn't have a background check done on them. So that's the scrutiny they're putting on it. But, I do feel like, they're more senior people right now are the only ones working on the trust. And that's why it's a little bit slower. But the goal is to change that so that, they're honest. The trust will probably never be as quick as the individual, but it might be a week or two longer. But to me, it's still probably worth it to go with a trust just because then if it's only a couple of weeks longer, then it allows you to share it and pick who gets it when you pass away, and it just makes life simpler.
We did have numerous questions about trusts, so we'll get to that. But to stick to this idea of approval times for a minute, I don't even know what this question means. It was a listener submitted question, so enlighten me, correct me, etc. But the question was, is it faster to do quote unquote ship to door, which he's talking about his personal address, which I know you guys are known for, or have it shipped to my local FFL? What I don't understand about this question, Brandon, is do you offer both options? Because I was aware of Silencer Central, being known for and offering like, hey, we can ship this suppressor to your door. Do you guys also offer an FFL delivery option? And if so, is there any difference in timeline?
Good question. It's something that no one's really ask us to offer because they like the idea of a single point of contact. So essentially we become, your dealer. And then we just mail it to your front door. Obviously if someone is a dealer and we do a transfer from us to that dealer, that's like probably 4 to 6 weeks to transfer to a dealer. So if that person is actually a dealer, that would be quicker. But the problem with us shipping it to your local FFL is it takes 4 to 6 weeks for the ATF to approve the transfer from us to your local dealer. And then it's incumbent upon the local dealer to A, do the paperwork correctly, submit it timely, all that stuff. Whereas us, we already have the product in inventory. So as soon as you buy it that day, we could start the paperwork. We can start doing everything we need to do to get in place to get it submitted. And I always say we have 150 people here. That's all they do every day is try to figure out how to get these submitted as quickly as possible because you don't get it unless we submit it quickly. And the tax people won't let me recognize that revenue until that silencer's in your hand. So there's a big incentive for us to try to get it to you as quickly as possible. So probably that person is just confused, not realizing that We actually have a federal farms license under Silencer Central's name. I've got employees in all 42 of those states that, think of all the paperwork is done in Sioux Falls on the what I would call NFA paperwork, the silencer paperwork, and then all the back end paperwork, like the Gun Control Act stuff, like 4473 and shipping it to your front door, that's managed locally in the state you live in, and they're the ones that ship it to your front door, but they work for me.
Gotcha. Pretty common question, and I know the information's out there, but just to one, address it, but two, I'd like to kind of hear your take on it. The question is there a way to get hold of the ATF to see a status update or an estimated time of approval? I know that when I started in this years ago, you can call the ATF, you can give them your what is it, your, I think, social or part of your social, and then the serial number, the suppressor, yada, yada, yada. They can look it up. But you also see people say, hey, don't call them, don't bug them. You're just slowing things down. So is that phone-based system still kind of the only way to get a status update? And if so, is it worthwhile?
Yeah, good question. So they do, and I was just looking at my phone trying to find it. The problem is when I search ATF, I've got every ATF agent I've ever met within here, so it's hard to figure out which one it is. But there is a phone number that you can call with ATF, and they will give you a status update, and they'll tell you exactly where it is in the process. Yeah, here's the NFA main number. So it's three. They're based in West Virginia, so the number is 304-616-4500. Again, it's 304-616-4500. What they're going to ask you for is, if it's in a trust, they're going to want to know the exact trust name. If it's in your name, they're going to want to know your full name. And if it is an individual, they probably won't ask for a social security number because it's not required on the paperwork, but they might ask for it. But they'll probably ask for the serial number so they can pull it up in the system and they'll tell you where it's at. Now, the hard part is sometimes they'll tell you it's pending, or sometimes they'll tell you that it's processing. So the information they give you is not necessarily all that helpful. In the past, it was beneficial when we used to mail the applications in, because there was always this lag time from when they mailed it till we got it. But now, as soon as the NFA branch approves it, you get an email and we get an email at the same time, so we both know it's approved. But it's not a, I think it gives some people peace to call that number occasionally and make sure that it's still in the system and it's still waiting there. I don't see any negatives in checking on it. Just realize they're not going to give you a ton of information. The person that's checking is basically just going into a database and telling you where it's at in the system. That doesn't really impact the people anywhere else in the building that are approving them and working them. So I don't see any negatives. It's not like they're going to put you at the back of the line or, put any kind of nasty gram or, and I do find they typically answer the phone pretty regularly, at least they have in the past. So it's a pretty quick call. You give them the information they request, they confirm you are who you say you are, and they check to make sure where it's at in the process. Again, like I've said, we have some systems in place where we work with ATF, because what I have seen is, like, maybe less than 5% of the approvals we get, for some reason we don't get the email and they can't explain why we didn't get the email. So we have a system where, like, every 2 weeks we reach out to them and say, hey, any of these that are older, have they been approved and you just didn't send us an email? And that'll catch those. But sometimes customers will call and say, hey, I heard it's approved. And it's like, okay, well, we didn't get an email, neither did you. So we're gonna have to reach out and get it. So it's rare, but if it gives someone peace of mind, hey, go for it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know that I called. I remember when I purchased my first suppressor, it was, again, years ago prior to e-file. So you didn't have this digital record. Everything was sent in by mail. You have a paperwork, you have a printed photo, you have fingerprints that are, on paper. And it was just like, hey, I just want to make sure this thing is like received. It's in process. I know they're not going to tell me when it's going to approve, but it was just that, as you said, peace of mind of knowing that it's there and it's going to happen eventually.
So there's no downside.
All right, so back to trusts. We had quite a few questions on trusts. And again, we talked more about trust, why you guys use trust in the previous podcast and more in depth. You've also talked about some of the benefits just in passing. But again, just to recap and answer this listener question, someone asked, how important is it to put a suppressor in a trust versus just owning or registering as an individual?
Yeah, good question. So, local dealers typically will sometimes discourage you from doing a trust because they feel like it's a barrier to keep you from buying. If it's not a service that they have access to or they have a way to help you with. And the paperwork honestly is more complicated for the dealer if it's a trust. So I'm not saying you have to be skeptical about local advice, but I would say just do research and think through it. The first few silencers I bought were in my own name. And the downside there is that once you pass away, somebody has to do what they call a Form 5 that transfers it from you to like a lawful heir. And the paperwork's pretty complicated. It's, I've been doing this long enough, almost 20 years. So when a widow calls and says, "Hey, I need help filling out this Form 5," it's difficult because they got to submit fingerprints of who's going to get it. They got to submit the photo. They got to fill out all the background check. They got to sign it properly. It's a mess. So for me, the ideal situation is to put it in a trust, and it's not a money thing for us because we give everyone a trust free. We just feel like it's the right way to go. Again, the benefits of the trust are you can add other people that want to use the suppressor. So, I've got daughters. Obviously, I would love for them never to get married and stay home, but that's not a reality. So eventually, I'm going to have probably son-in-laws and grandkids and things like that, and to have the ability to put them on the trust, because in simplest terms, the trust will own the silencer. So think of the trust as almost like an entity that's owning the silencer, and then you can change who is on that trust, who can use and possess that suppressor. And the other benefit is they only have to be 18; they don't have to be 21. So for me as a dealer to sell you a silencer, you have to be 21, but on a trust, you only have to be 18. It's sort of like a handgun; you can legally possess a handgun in most states at 18. You just can't buy one unless you're 21 because the dealer can't transfer it. So the benefit is you can share it with other people very easily. Just a stroke of a pen adds people to the trust. And then the other benefit is you can pick who gets it when you pass away, just like a beneficiary who can inherit it. So on the back end, once you pass away, there's essentially no paperwork. It keeps it very clean. So in my mind, the trust is the best way to go. I know right now people are seeing all this, quick approvals because they did as an individual, so they're driven to want to do as an individual, and I totally get that. And people are, saying, "Hey, I want to get as an individual, and then once I get it, then switch it to a trust." My only caution is that, the goal is the ATF's going to speed up the trust here pretty quickly, and I feel like they will. The other hard part is what you're seeing out there probably is kind of an anomaly. When you see people get approved in 2 or 3 days, some of those might have been the batch processing I talked about, where maybe they bought one 3 days ago, but they also had five or six in the hopper from previous months, and those previous months got approved, and then they pushed everything forward that was pending at the same time. So it almost kind of cherry picks it, makes it look like some of those are quicker approvals than they really were because they were part of a batch. So, again, I like the trust personally. I think it adds more value to the customer. And since we offer it free and we also help you edit it and make changes to it free, it seems like a no-brainer, but everyone, I guess, has to make their own decision.
So all that said, a very direct question that came through from a listener said, "Why does Silencer Central only offer trusts?" I think you kind of answered that question, but also said, "Will this ever change?" So
Yeah,
I'm
yes, good.
assuming
Yeah.
no.
No, that's a good question. So we have gotten requests, hey, and we're doing them manually right now. So, it's funny because that was my first question for our team is how hard would it be to switch to individuals? So we're in the process of doing that so we can make that as a quick, easy offering. Because right now we're doing it kind of manually, a little bit one-off, but our system is all computerized sitting on Oracle NetSuite, and our system will do 1,000 forms an hour. So think of this like massive assembly line that's all digitally set up. So basically, we just need to add another switch in there that lets you kind of pick a route where you either go individual or you go trust. Because to me, it seems simple with my team. I'm like, gosh, it's basically doing it as an individual is a subset of doing it as a trust because it's just less information. But I get it. When we capture your information, we're creating a trust for you. So we'd have to turn that off. The responsible party form we have you fill out now, we have to turn that off. So there's some things internally that we're going to, fine tune, but right now we're able to do them manually, but the goal would be to offer it where we could do them digitally just as easy here pretty quick. So the answer is yes, we will change that.
Gotcha. Just to step back real quick, when we were talking about trusts and having other people on them, and you mentioned age of being 18 versus 21 to purchase, all good info. I did just want to, I was trying to think of a listener's perspective who are maybe new to all this and don't understand the regulations. Someone who is not 18 or someone who's 80 for that matter can shoot your suppressor, just has to be, you have to be there and in possession of it. So this idea of like trusts, and you mentioned your daughters or grandsons in the future, et cetera, as long as you're there and in possession of the suppressor, they can shoot it with you. This talk of other people on a trust, that's for them to essentially have independent possession. Hopefully
Yeah.
that makes sense. And feel free to clarify anything there, Brandon.
Yeah, no, excellent point. So, I get more out of ATF one-on-one than I do in paper. So just like having, I try to meet with them 3 or 4 times a year. So in a past meeting, the way they explain it to me is if you can still see the suppressor, so like if someone's hunting with you and they're across the field somewhere, as long as you can still see them, you haven't lost possession of it yourself and somebody else can use it. So you're right. Like if you've bought it as a trust or as an individual, if someone is there with you hunting or shooting or target practice or whatever, that's 100% fine, as long as they're not like a prohibited person. And then you're right. So to be on the trust allows sort of independent possession, so that someone wants to go to a different state or hunt, or someone's going to go hunt without you being there. Being on the trust allows you to do that. Whereas as if you're an if it's owned as an individual and it's in your name, you have to be super careful. You can't even leave it in the car, and then your wife bars your car. She potentially get in trouble for that if the law enforcement wanted to push the issue.
Speaking of all that, Brandon, as a side note, my son shot his first buck this past fall and was using the Banish suppressor. I love having a suppressor for shooting with kids.
Oh, exciting. Yeah. No, that's awesome. That's super cool. What caliber do you use?
He was shooting a little 300 blackout pistol.
Ah, perfect. Ah, it's
Yeah.
cool. Love it.
Yeah. So it was
Blackouts
neat.
are super quiet with a suppressor.
Yeah, for sure. All right. I don't want to get derailed on hunting stories now. Back to trusts.
Yeah, sorry.
So a question came through. It says, how do I add someone to my trust, and does it matter if they reside in the same state?
Yeah, good question. So, it's hard for me to tell you if they bought from someone else, but if they bought from us, we have a template that we help kind of like you tell us who you want to add, and then we just type it in and we send you a PDF form and you basically just sign it. So we manage all that for you. So if you bought one from us, just give us a call. And what we're going to ask you for is that person's full name. And then we'll have your trust on file. We'll just have to put the name of that trust in, and we'll put the inception date of when that trust was created. And we'll take care of, all that for you.
Okay. Can Silencer Central help to combine trust from previously purchased suppressors which have trust that were not established by Silencer Central? That's the question. I would also add to that, same kind of concept, but previously owned suppressors that are registered as an individual, and can those be combined into a trust established by Silencer Central?
Yeah, good question. So, combining trusts would be difficult just because think of them as their own separate individual entity. So there, I don't know of any way to like combine them. What the feds will do though is you could pay the $200 tax. We can help you do it. It's basically another Form 4 transfer. You don't have to give the silencer up. You would still hold it, but we would essentially transfer the silencer, and the concept is the same. So the silencer would transfer from either you as an individual or your previous trust, and then you could transfer it to a new trust. But of course, the feds charge 200 and you have to wait. Of course, the waiting doesn't matter because you're already in possession of a suppressor. So you see this more common, like you said, as an individual. So I'll meet guys at shows that say, hey, I kind of screwed up. I bought as an individual. I like the idea you guys do a free trust. If I buy a silencer today from you, will you help me move some of my others into a trust? And typically we'll work with you on that. It just because we'll have the trust in front of us and we already have all the paperwork, so we can help you move stuff over if you're buying something from us at the same time. So yeah, we're definitely able to help, people do that because we will already have your fingerprints on file. We'll already have your photo. We'll be able to send it to you, or you can sign it digitally, with DocuSign. So we could definitely help facilitate that as well.
Yeah. And then again, those, especially for an individual who's wanting to put it into the trust, as you said, that is a essentially another transfer, another form four. So you are paying per item, you're paying that additional tax stamp.
Yes, correct. Yes, which is kind of a negative. So the other way, and I don't know that I've had anyone use this way, but it is an interesting way. So I talked earlier about a Form 5. So once you pass away, I always say the ATF will give you one free transfer in your lifetime, and it's when you die. So if you have it as an individual, you could put in your will that your trust gets it, and then your family would do a Form 5, which would transfer it from you as an individual to that trust you've created with other silencers in it. So then that would be a free transfer. But there would be, some paperwork. You could potentially do it ahead of time and have your family submit it after you pass away. But that is an option too, that you could do a free transfer from your, personal estate into your NFA gun trust that we created for you, at no charge by the ATF.
This I don't know how to ask this question, Brandon, because it's a new thought. It's not something that was on our list to get through today, so it's not a listener question. This is just me thinking.
Sure.
This talk of Silencer Central, you guys are establishing this trust for free. I know very little about a trust, but understanding the concept, as you said, it's kind of like a legal entity, etc. Although you are setting up the trust through Silencer Central, you're offering this service. Silencer Central doesn't own or doesn't have to manage the trust in perpetuity, meaning like the trust that I have through Silencer Central legally is mine and doesn't tie me forever to make any changes to that trust in the future or what have you, and essentially have to rely on Silencer Central, correct?
Yeah, good point. No, totally. And the only clarification I would make is, you know, obviously we're not a law firm. And the reason why I've always given the trust away free is because, you know, in South Dakota and in most states, if you practice law and you're not a lawyer, it's a felony. So being a pharmacist myself, I'm pretty astute into trying to read like state laws and make sure we're not doing anything we shouldn't. So basically we consider it a template. You know, it's basically a trust created by attorneys, reviewed in each state. And then that template, we're kind of filling out for you. We're putting in there, you know, what's your full name? You know, what's your spouse's full name, or who would you want to leave this trust to if you passed away? And then who would you want to leave it to after you pass away? So kind of that those two separate things. But no, totally. Once you establish, so essentially we have a template. We're creating a trust kind of on your behalf just through a template. And then once you establish and sign your trust and make it, you know, a viable legal entity in your state. One thing you didn't ask is, but no state really has any requirements. You don't have to take it down to the courthouse. You don't have to file with the courthouse. There's no EIN number, so no kind of business tax liabilities or any issues like that. But you're right, it's yours. So you could use it to do a Form 1 and make your own silencer, or you could use it to do a Form 1 and make a short barrel rifle. You could use it to go buy from someone else, or you know, I have an addiction to machine guns. So you could go buy a machine gun from your buddy and have it transferred into that. And we're not a part of that either. So yeah, it's totally, it's a, you know, universal NFA gun trust that you could use anywhere.
You mentioned spouse. That was one of the questions. I'll just read it. It said, "What is the best way for a husband and wife to fill out the paperwork and both be on a tax stamp?"
Yes, good question. So again, this is my insight, and this was very interesting to me with ATF because when I first, so ATF changed this in like August of 2016. Obama, you know, he decided it was a loophole because years ago, people would buy under a trust. The trust was considered an entity, and by law, there was no background check on an entity. So that's the way the federal law was written originally, which, you know, of course, we liked. And then you would do a background check on whoever came and picked the silencer up, but you could have as many people on the trust as you wanted. So Obama saw that as a loophole, and then he created ATF 41 and became 41F, the final ruling, which now requires a background check with everyone on the trust. So my insight is we would just put, let's say the wife is buying the silencer, we would only put the wife on the trust. We would let her go through the process, get the background check done, fill out all the forms, and then basically at the end of the day, that transfer from Silencer Central to her trust, she would be the responsible person signing on behalf of the trust, that 4473. And then once that transfer is done, we would add her husband, and there's no expense to do that. There's no vetting with the ATF. There's no background check. Basically, a stroke of a pen adds her husband to the trust. So that would be our recommendation, just because it's less of a process for the two customers, and it's also easier for it to go more quickly through the ATF process, and it has the same end results with less work for everybody. So that would be the recommendation that we would take, because a lot of people do say, hey, you know, I'm at an event, I'm interested in getting a silencer, my wife's not here, I don't want to get it, I want her to be on the trust. And we just remind them that, you know, we get it, we totally understand, but why don't you just buy today, get it started, and once it's approved, with a stroke of a pen, you can add her within a few minutes, and she doesn't have to go through any of the vetting, no background check, no fingerprints, no photo, no digital signatures, and not in the ATF system. And 100% of the time, they go, yep, let's do it.
All right, so we got into a lot of nitty-gritty on trusts. Let's get into more suppressors, the product, the design, performance, etc., and answer questions that kind of came through under that umbrella. First one being, is the length of the suppressor the primary factor in determining the amount of sound reduction?
Good question. Not necessarily. So what I've seen, at least from my engineers internally, is that typically it is a volume thing, but think about volume could also be increased by increasing the diameter of the tube. So when I first started doing this, it was pretty consistent that all rimfires were an inch diameter tube and all 30 cals and 223s were an inch and a half diameter. But if you look now at, say, like the backcountry, you're looking at like a 1.6, 1.62 diameter, and you can even get bigger diameter and then make it shorter. But what's interesting is, I read all these reports about companies using airflow technology and gas technology and all these things. But the people I've talked to over the years that have created and made silencers that are super quiet, it's 100% trial and error. I've seen my engineers come in with a design that, is really, really quiet. And then what they'll do is maybe they'll make that blast chamber larger so there's more space for the gas to sit there before it exit, and that might make it quieter. Or they may actually tighten that space up, and that might make it quieter. And what's interesting is some of these universal suppressors that kind of one of the catch-alls that works on everything, if you will, kind of everything's in quotes. It might be super quiet on a 338, but it might be loud on a 223, or it might be super quiet on, a 450 SOCOM, but then it's loud on a 223. So, my advice on silencers is what weapon do you shoot the most? And whatever weapon you shoot the most, look at getting a suppressor for that. It doesn't mean it has to be 100% specific for that. But my insight is that once you use that, it's going to work so much better than you even thought it would. It'll be so much easier for you to think about getting another one. Because I would say I'm very fiscally responsible. And the first suppressor I bought, I figured would be my only one. But I liked it so much, I bought some for every gun just in case I had a friend that went hunting with me. I didn't want them to screw my hunt up. I loved it so much. And that's just been my experience. 100% of people that hunt with a suppressor, 100% of the time they say, I'll never hunt without a suppressor again. So, to go back to the question, if you're looking for an end all be all, I do find that typically the number of baffles has a stronger correlation to sound suppression than necessarily length. Because when I look at some of the suppressors that have 10, 12 baffles in them, our designs will be quieter than even if you had the same volume with half as many baffles in it. So I know that probably doesn't answer the question, but I would say also try to think about all the other benefits. Typically hunters want lightweight, so you'll notice that pretty much every suppressor, Silencer Central, makes and then sells underneath our name are all titanium. And the goal is titanium is stronger, and titanium is what they use in the military for making missiles and things that they need to be light and also strong. So that's a good option for the hunter. If someone's using like a belt-fed machine gun, they may want something that's heat-treated stainless steel and Inconel and, a completely different type product. But to overgeneralize it, I would say the number of baffles typically has a more direct correlation than length of suppressor, if that answers their question.
I mean, I think it answers it in the sense of it's not as easy to answer as you'd think. It's not just about length,
Totally.
right?
No, totally. Because it's always that balance of, how do you make it light? How do you make it quiet? And I would say from our brain always wakes up from the customer perspective of a hunter, just with us being based at Dakotas. I worked gun shows and still do for, gosh, almost 20 years now. And that's the biggest customer in most of the areas we go to are hunters. So they're wanting something that A is quiet and B is light, and then they don't want much length on the end.
All right. Next question was, why is no one doing over the barrel suppressors to reduce the overall length?
Good question. I haven't heard that question in a while. There's a company in Kansas that makes one. So here's my skepticism on it. When I tested them, they don't test that great. So a couple issues with that. So one, think of the blast coming out of the silencer, and most of the suppression is going to be in front of where the blast happens. So I do say that most consumers do like this idea of something that goes over the barrel because they feel like some of the gas can go backwards. But just think about all that pressure is wanting to go forward. So what we found is when I've tested ones that do kind of go over the barrel and it goes behind where the blast went, it just doesn't, because there's no baffling in there. It's just creating a larger expansion chamber, which can have some benefits, but I have not seen it be any more efficient. In other words, maybe you're able to save 2 inches on the silencer length by going over the barrel. If you just made the silencer fatter, you could make up for that. So why create that complexity of going over the barrel? The other concern I have is the ATF is funny about silencer parts. So anything used specifically for only a silencer by federal definition is a silencer part and is a silencer. So the ATF recently came out with in their FFL newsletter that an end cap. So sometimes you'll see people switch out end caps. So you might buy a 30 cal silencer, but you say, hey, I want to buy a little bit tighter, smaller hole for my 223, and I want a 223 end cap. ATF recently came out and said that that is a silencer part and that should be transferred just like a silencer with a serial number and a $200 tax stamp. And so, we got a cease and desist from ATF years ago. So we quit selling them just because they kind of told us that we couldn't. And they said someone told on us for doing that. So if you see other people out there selling them, they probably read the same FFL newsletter we did, but maybe no one has told on them and they didn't get a cease and desist like we did. But what I'm thinking is the problem with going over the barrel is some people shoot a bull barrel, some people shoot a pencil barrel, some people shoot a standard barrel. So if you had to have an adapter to make your silencer work that went on the back of the silencer and you had to adapt to each size based on the barrel size you're using for that firearm, I could see the ATF saying that that's a silencer part because that screws onto the silencer and it's a part is only used in a silencer. So the company I mentioned in here in Kansas, not too far from here, they make one that goes over the count over the barrel. They say the ATF has approved their part. I haven't seen that letter, so obviously I'm naturally skeptical. Because I guess their argument would be it's the same as like a muzzle brake or something like that. Of course, I would argue a muzzle brake you could shoot without the suppressor, but to have this end piece that adapts based on the size of the barrel so that you can change the size of the silencer, I think could create an issue with ATF. So that could be one reason why people have been scared to do that. Because what you don't want is to make 4 or 5,000 of these and an ATF, after all the customers have them, says that's a silencer part. And now they're in violation because they're in possession of something that, they shouldn't have. That would be my guess. I know at one point this company in Kansas had partnered up with CZ and made silencers for them, and then that partnership went away. So I don't know if that's indicative on that design just didn't work well, or maybe CZ didn't market it well. I don't know. So that's sort of my feedback on going over the barrel. I would say a lot of consumers ask that, and I think the consumer probably has a misconception that that would be a major benefit because you're not adding length. My response would be, if your goal is more volume, why not just make the silencer a little bit fatter? Everyone's using scopes now. They're not using front sights to sight stuff in. So if you get a little bit fatter, it's not like you're going to block your front sight because you're probably using a scope anyway.
I wasn't aware of that that ruling on suppressor parts and like end caps.
Yeah, it's tough for me because customers calling, I mean, they're like, hey, I want to buy an end cap. And I'm like, yeah, I want to sell you one, but I got to cease
Right.
this. I mean, it was
When
kind of
did that
strange.
happen?
I'd have to look back at my notes.
I mean, roughly.
Actually, I remember it was because I had a meeting with ATF the week after that at headquarters, just me and them. And it was a very memorable meeting. So November 2019 is when I got the cease and desist from them. And I got a call from the head of the criminal division, which is different. Usually when you talk to ATF, it's the industry side, and the industry side basically regulates the industry. They can control whether you have an FFL or you don't. This was a call from the criminal side, which is, kind of the handcuffed people. So when the head of the ATF for the state of South Dakota called and said, are you in your office? I'm like, yes. They said, I'll be there in 40 minutes or 20 minutes or whatever. And they showed up at my door and hand delivered a cease and desist letter. So I was like, oh, this is not good.
Yeah, holy smokes.
Yeah. And then, it just chaps you a little bit when you see everyone else is doing it. And then also, someone told on you. So it's like, all right, it is what it is, but it's just unfortunate. I, like my friends say, the unfortunate reality is they have a monopoly on interpreting the rules.
That's a good way to put it. All right, so this next question we've talked about, but I want to also ask the question directly and kind of make sure that what we've mentioned is summarized here. The question is, how well do larger caliber suppressors work when used on smaller caliber rifles? Do they lose much performance and efficiency? So he didn't say this specifically, but getting at the idea of a 30 caliber suppressor on a 6.5 or a 6 millimeter or a 223.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. It's a common question. So the example I would say is like we have a Banish 30 that is modular, so you can make it 7 inches or 9 inches. So think of it as a 9-inch suppressor. And then we have a Banish 223 that's 7 inches. So the question would be, how effective is my bolt action 223 going to be with a 30 cal Banish 30? What I would say is that It's typically quieter if you can get the exact bore size. So if you bought a 223, it's typically going to be quieter. If you bought a specific 223 can, it's typically going to be quieter than if you got a 30. But the difference with the Banish 30 and the Banish 223 is you're adding 2 inches on there. So you got two additional baffles. So we see it comparable. So if you use a, 30 cal suppressor on a 223, because it's longer, you typically are going to have comparable performance. It might be a little bit quieter with a 223, but of course it would also be shorter. But most people, since they're having to go through the process and get one, and typically that's like our number one seller for a first time purchase is a Banish 30 because it is so universal. I think if you sat there with a naked ear and you didn't have a meter there, you're not really going to be able to tell a difference, especially with a bolt action. Sometimes if you shoot an AR with a 223, just that action opening up is like 125 decibels. So that can sort of mislead you and make you feel like it was louder than it actually was. But if you have a bolt action 223 and a bolt action 30 and you use them both on a 30 cal, you're going to be pleased. But to the question too, we've looked at making like say a 6.5 specific silencer. I mean, my only concern is going back to the whole end cap discussion. I always have this fear that someone's going to put, a 6.5 suppressor on their 30 cal and it's going to create an issue or it's going to, potentially hurt the consumer. I still find that most people, just because it might be a decibel or two louder to get a 30 cal and use it on a 6.5, most people do that. They just get a 30 cal and use it on all of their, 270. I was in January, I was shooting wolves with a 257. So most people use a 30 cal on pretty much everything in that, 22, 250 all the way up to a 300 Remington Ultramag, everything in between.
Yeah, that's been one of my concerns. Like when I purchased my first one, and Steve did at the same time, he got a 6.5 specific suppressor. I got a 30 caliber suppressor. He knew, hey, I'm not going to shoot anything bigger than a 6.5. Whereas for me, I knew, well, I already have a 30 cal. I hunt mostly with a 7 millimeter. I have a 6.5, shoot 223. Like I'm shooting a lot of calibers, and this idea of putting a smaller caliber suppressor on the wrong rifle accidentally. I know like that sounds very basic, but as you begin to own multiple rifles, potentially multiple suppressors, get something mixed up, like that's a recipe for some danger.
Yes, totally agree. Yes, and maybe it's like my background being a pharmacist. Just you want to make sure you get the right prescription for the right customer. So yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So this is an interesting question I hadn't quite thought of. A guy wrote in and said, how does weather and environmental variables affect the performance of a suppressor? What I've noticed is surroundings can matter. So like, I mean, there's one range I shoot at that they're on one side, there's kind of a, they dug this, they didn't dig it out, but they cut into a hillside. And so there's a rock bluff on one side of the range. And I can definitely tell shooting suppressed or non-suppressed, like that rock bluff is going to reverberate sound, even shooting suppressed versus a truly open area. So I'd say that terrain I've noticed, but in terms of like weather or other environmental variables, I've never even thought of that.
Yeah, good question. So, what I've seen with suppressors is when you use a meter and test them, you do have to adjust for that based on like altitude and things like that so that you keep it consistent because it can change. I think one of the biggest call-outs for me is I had a guy, oral surgeon, who bought a lot of suppressors for me, and he told me that in the winter it would spook his horses a little bit when he would shoot, and that's why when he even when he moved to a suppressor, he just said he could tell a difference in the summer versus when it's super cold. Now, of course, he's in Aberdeen, South Dakota, so it's like probably negative 20, negative 40, which is not, the average person's going to see, but it can change how that sound travels and maybe the pitch of it. So it could potentially be louder when it's super, super cold out, than it would be when there's maybe more moisture in the air, and also it just won't travel as fast the sound. But I think it could there could be impact based on weather, atmosphere, hot, cold, and typically it's just how you're hearing it. It's probably the same sound, but it just can travel differently through the air based on sort of, the actual environment or climate there. So it can vary, but I don't think it's going to be big enough where someone's going to necessarily, call it out. Like I said, the only example I'd ever heard was a guy said it changed the tone enough, it made the tone a little bit higher at a different pitch when it was in really super cold, and it sort of would, if he was, he had a bench set up right next to where his horses were, it spooked them a little bit more, just, you know, than it would when it was, nice and warm out. But no, it's a good question. It can impact for sure. But I agree with you that the biggest impact you see is if you're shooting something that echoes. So I grew up in the South. So when you shoot around a lot of trees, you get more echo. But out here in the Dakotas, where you got nothing but a prairie, when you shoot, it's super quiet because there's so much area for that shot to dissipate that you almost don't hear it.
Let's see. This question came through. It says, can you use the Banish backcountry on larger calibers, including 30 caliber magnums?
Yes. So the Banish backcountry is rated up to a 300 Remington Ultramag. It's actually hearing safe on a 300 Remington Ultramag. So anything 300 rum down.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty common, again, for people who are new to this. I would say, well, I don't want to say most manufacturers. Many that I've looked at do have recommendations both for caliber or cartridge and also for barrel length,
Yes.
which is good to look at as well, especially as more people go shorter and shorter in barrels.
Yes, totally true. Good point.
All right, so that covered a lot of kind of the product specific questions. There was a few that I just called miscellaneous. To start here, is it possible to sell a suppressor that I own? This person wrote a longer question. He was basically saying, hey, I bought this one suppressor. I realized I want this other one. I don't think I'm going to use this other one that I originally purchased too much in the future, et cetera, et cetera. Essentially, can I sell it?
Yeah, good question. So let's go back to the trust. So if you had a trust, you could add that person to the trust and essentially hand it to them, which is pretty nice. I mean, of course, your name's still on there. So, if you trusted the person, we usually say, hey, if they have a concealed carry, hopefully you could trust them. That's an option. You know, the other option is if they're in the same state that you're in, then you have to, you could do a Form 4 with an individual. So, like, let's say I own a silencer. And I want to sell it to someone else who's in my state. The Form 4, the same form that I fill out as a dealer to transfer the silencer from me to the end user, is the same form the customer would fill out. Now, the problem is they got to pay the $200 tax. So by the time you start having to do all the paperwork and pay the $200 tax, that creates the question of, is it really worth it? And that's, it's up to the person to determine. I'm very familiar with it, again, for buying machine guns. Now, if they're out of state, that's where it gets complicated. So let's say that you live in Missouri, I live in South Dakota. You would have to transfer that silencer from yourself to a South Dakota dealer, and then that dealer would have to transfer it to me. So that's two tax stamps. So that's $400 that it would cost to transfer that silencer to me from out of state. And that reminds me, I didn't answer your other question where you ask about adding people on a trust from another state. That's 100% fine, even if they're not legal in that state. So I have a famous football player that lives in a state that they're not lawful where he lives. He lives in Chicago. So he and I created a trust together. I store the suppressors here in my cabinet in my office drawer. And then whenever he goes hunting in Texas or a state where they're legal, I ship the silencers to him there and he can use them and then he just ships them back to me. But he was in town doing this event and, he came by and wanted a suppressor, and I said, "Well, we'll figure out a way." My dad went to college where he graduated from, and he's a Heisman Trophy winner and pretty famous guy. So I said, "We'll figure it out," and that's what we came up with. And ATF approved it.
Remind me, like in that, I know that's a unique scenario, but shipping.
Yeah.
You're shipping directly to him as the individual at whatever, like say he goes to Texas and he's hunting so and so ranch. You're just shipping directly to that location,
Yep, and
not
I'm putting
through a
it.
dealer.
Correct. And I'm putting it in to his name directly so only he can open it. So basically, it's a package directly to him. So, again, silencer is owned by the trust. The two people on the trust are me and him. I did send him through the process. I didn't add him later. So it did create a call from ATF and we had a conference call and it created a long discussion of, all right, why are we adding someone in downtown Chicago to your trust that you're keeping at your office? And I was like, well, he comes here and hunts too. So when he comes here to prairie dog hunt, he wants to be able to use a suppressor that is his. And then if he goes and hunts somewhere else, same thing. But yeah, you would just mail it directly to them. The problem with shipping it to a dealer is the dealer would have to put it in their books, and then they can't get it out of their books unless the person went through a Form 4 process. So if a silencer is approved on a Form 4, there's no way to get it off a Form 4 without paying $200.
Got it. So Steve lives in Idaho. I have a trust here in Missouri for this presser that I purchased through Silencer Central. I could add Steve to my trust and then just mail that suppressor directly to him in Idaho.
You could. Yep,
Okay.
absolutely.
Interesting. All right. You touched on this earlier. You kind of said that 100% of people who hunt with a suppressor say they'll never hunt with a suppressor again. But this question did come through and said, are there any times when it is beneficial to hunt or shoot without a suppressor?
That's a good question. So, I've run into customers before that say, "Hey, I feel like it's a little long on there, so it's creating a deterrent for me to want to have to walk with it and carry with it." So then, of course, we say, "Hey, we have shorter models. That backcountry is 5.5 inches, and by the time you screw it on your barrel, it's going to take up three-fourths of an inch of that. So you're not even adding 5 inches to the end of your barrel, and that typically resolves it." I'm going to Zimbabwe in July and they don't let silencers happen. So I guess that's a scenario where I got to sight my rifle without it. Like I said, I was wolf hunting in Canada in January and they don't allow suppressors. So I can't think of a time where you wouldn't, just because of all the benefits of recoil reduction. And when I have hunted in Africa, the professional hunter and the tracker, they love it because they can hear the impact of the shot and tell exactly whether it was a kill shot, and they kind of know what's next, for them. And also for, you as a hunter, if you're gonna have to start shooting more rounds because it wasn't a kill shot. But yeah, honestly, that's a good question. I can't think of any time that people at shows say, "Oh, I want people to hear me," and they have all these kind of responses. And of course, my response is, "Okay, well, you're probably a felon. You can't own one anyway, but that's okay." But no, I can't think of any negatives or any reason why somebody would want, because it speeds up your velocity. It typically helps your accuracy, having a little bit of weight on the end of the barrel. It's quiet. It doesn't scare other game that are out there. I can't see a reason where you would say, "Hey, I don't think I want to use a silencer to hunt today."
Yeah, I mean, I'm personally kind of in that camp. Once I did it, I was like, man, I can't imagine going back. So
Yeah. No,
it's been
totally.
years
Yeah.
and I haven't hunted without one since.
Yeah, because I talked to some of these people that manage farms where they have to go in and do doe management. Or I was hunting a couple weeks ago, Hawdad, and they said they have to shoot 200 to 300 females a year. And they said there's no way we could do that without a suppressor.
Yeah. I want to ask you a very frank question. I'm not, I don't know. This is a very, I guess, blunt question, Brandon. You guys sell through Silencer Central. You have your suppressors, like the ones that you guys have designed, et cetera, the Banish suppressors. And there's, as you said, there's Banish 30, Banish 223. We've talked about Banish Backcountry. There's a giant Banish 338, Banish 22. Like you have a Banish for everything.
Yeah.
But you also do. If someone wants to call Silencer Central or use your process, you sell suppressors from other manufacturers as well.
Yeah, 100%.
I guess my question is, when someone calls and they're talking about like, hey, I'm new to suppressors, here's what I'm looking to do, here's what, et cetera, like you guys are happy to sell you what you think is the best suppressor for their needs, even if it's not a Banish suppressor? Because you have a Banish suppressor for everything. So I guess I'm just getting at for people. Because I see so many questions on comparing suppressors and which one's right. And as we've talked about, it's not easy to, buy one and sell one or, quote unquote, try one and make a different decision necessarily. Just in terms of advice on selecting a suppressor, since you have yours, but you also sell others,
Yeah.
how does
No,
that
good
work?
question. Yeah, good question. I can't remember if I answered this on the first podcast, but the reason why we went to creating our own suppressor was a couple things. One, I used to only work gun shows. So January, February, March, and April, because we're in an agricultural area. In the winter, farmers didn't have as much to do, and that was mostly our customers were ranchers and farmers. So almost 100% of my inventory I needed in the first quarter of the year, and I couldn't find anyone that could supply me with that much inventory. And the other problem I had is, back in 2005, when I started, really honestly, every suppressor on the market was created pretty much for like what I would call a tactical audience. It was made, everything was built around a tactical shooter, sort of a target shooter. So that's why I could just tell by the consumer reaction that, "Hey, this is too heavy," or, "That's great that it can handle a belt fed, but I'm not using a belt fed." So, it helped us say, "Hey, we got to evolve something the customer actually wants that would benefit a hunter." And then also it was, "Hey, we have to be in control of our own fate." I can't sell 100,000 silencers a year and hope that somebody else can figure out how to manufacture that many and I can buy it from them. So it was created sort of out of consumer demand and then also just efficiency of making the process easy for the consumer for us to come up with our own products. But question about selling other people's products. Yes. So most manufacturers out there, we're their largest dealer in the country. And I think at first they were probably hesitant to sell to us directly because they saw us as a competitor because we had our own product and we had a process. My consumer insight is that 99.9% of the people that have never bought a silencer, it's because they're intimidated by the process. So it made sense for me as a business-minded individual and also as a suppressor shooter to say, hey, how do I make the process easy if that's 100% of the reason why people aren't buying them? So once we made the process easy, then it's like, gosh, so many people agree with us. They're wanting to buy them. How do I get supply to kind of funnel this to make sure that it is going to be a quick and simple process? And if I don't have inventory on the shelf, then I can't do that. But most of these manufacturers, I think, were skeptical at first of us. But over time, now they're selling direct to us. Now they're training my salespeople on their products. Now we have good relationships with them and they communicate with us and tell us what are the sort of reasons for their product and the niches they cover. And what I find is that, yeah, our sales guys are good. I mean, I don't sit on the phones with them, but I do work shows with them and I do have them say, well, okay, what do you shoot? What's the application? What's the, bullet size? What's, is it hunting? Is it target shooting? And I see them mentally sort of design a suppressor for that customer based on that. And agreed, it's not always ours. I would say our market is, probably 100% hunting. And, everyone that's shooting suppressed out there is not 100% hunters. So there's tons of area for other products. But what I do find is people search online, they see we carry a product that maybe they've seen at their local dealer or their buddy has, and then they call and just say, hey, I want to get this X product that I saw on your website because I love the idea of your process. If you ship it to our front door, I can do it all from my couch. I can do everything digitally and you let me pay while I wait with no interest. I'm in, I'm interested. And then, so a lot of times it's them calling with, hey, I want this brand. And we say, sure, that's no problem. We've gotten better stocking other brands. In the past, we would sort of, maybe didn't buy as many because we didn't know how much we were going to sell. But as our website's gotten more popular, we're getting more traffic, we're doing more advertising. What you'll see is almost 100% of Silencer Essentials advertising is around the process because, again, I'm convinced that's the reason why people don't buy. And then once they come to our website, it's kind of up to them to look at the website and see which one they're interested in or call us, and then we can help them with that decision as well. But no, I mean, I know that specifically Silencer Co. I've had podcasts with them and with their CEO, and they were honest. Hey, we were a little skeptical at first, but after we got to know Silencer Central, got to know their process, in some cases they're selling twice as many as our next biggest dealer just because people love their process and it's been a good win-win for both of us. So yeah, I think that the market's evolving, and I think that at one point during COVID, we probably overproduced Banish. So we didn't put as many products on our website trying to direct more people to Banish. But as we've gotten other manufacturers caught up where they could send us product where that we couldn't get from them before, and as we've managed our inventory more effectively, almost real time, then we're happy to sell what anybody wants. It's worked out well because we do outsource our manufacturing to military contractors. So we have probably not as great of a margin because we're hiring someone to do it. Whereas a manufacturer who is in control of their own manufacturing sometimes can sell us a product where honestly the margins are very similar to what we are paying someone to make it for us versus what they're selling it to us for. So it ends up creating a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, that's cool to hear. I didn't mean to blindside you with that question. I didn't know it's a blunt
No, it's
one.
a
It's
good
just
question.
something I
Oh,
thought
no,
of
I.
after.
No, totally. And I always find I'm not good about mentioning that. Like, it's
Yeah.
always because people say, hey, sometimes they'll put me on the spot and say, what's your favorite suppressor? And I always say, hey, I've only really honestly ever shot the suppressors that we make and that I've helped be a part of designing. So, of course, I personally have a natural bias just because I haven't been in the sales training. I've always been out of town and we've had other companies come in and train our folks. But, yeah, I mean, I guess the other thing is this is also an invitation. If there's other manufacturers out there that want us to sell their product, we would love to sell their product. Our only request is that we want to be able to buy direct because we want to be able to order, 500 to 1,000 at a time. We don't want to have to go through a wholesaler that says, hey, you can only order, 10 or 15 because we have all these other stores that want to order it too. We want to do $1 million purchase orders, not, $50 purchase orders. So, Yeah, that's and I've seen that catch on. That trend's going more and more manufacturers are getting into it. So it's creating a win-win. I mean, I would say our internal goal is to increase our market share on the number of Form 4s that we do because we feel like that's the way to win. It's our goal internally is our focus, I would say, is really 100% corporately is on our process because that's something unique to us. That's something we fine-tuned over the last 20 years, and there's no one else doing it, and there's no one else as efficient at the process as we are with this business model of a single point of contact, and then it shows up at your front door. So that's really our focus as an organization. And by us saying we want to do more Form 4s, the only way we're going to do that is to work with other manufacturers. So we're excited to work with other manufacturers. A lot of them are calling us, which is great.
Well, thank you so much for the time, Brandon. I'm excited to share this. In particular, I love suppressors. I love shooting suppressed. I love hunting suppressed. We get a lot of questions. Like, that's all my personal selfish ambition.
Yeah.
But also just the fact that we were able to spend all of our time today directly answering listener questions. So thanks for taking the time to do it.
Absolutely, yeah.
I will leave a link in the show description to our previous podcast, which again went much more like in depth on your background, why Silencer Central started, and exactly how the process works.
Good.
Also, of course, we'll leave a link to your website, but any other resources, anything you want to kind of conclude with and tell folks who may be listening?
You know, I always try to give a push about our dedication to conservation because I think it's important with the audience. You know, we're on track to give $5 million away in conservation this year. And, you
Wow.
know, two things. One, it's important to us to give back, to find some way to give back, but also it helps A, get our name out there and also helps people realize you can hunt suppress because we feel like that's a huge opportunity for us. So if there are people that are listening that are a part of a local charitable event where you guys need a silencer donated, what we do is we'll send you a certificate for a free silencer and then you get to keep 100% of those proceeds. So most of the major conservation groups in America, we are their number one contributor, and it's 100% free donation. So again, it helps us get our name out there. It helps people become aware with the idea of hunting suppressed, but then also it gives back to these local organizations. I know Ducks Unlimited, their goal is to raise well over $1 million just as one organization with this. So I would say if you are a part of any local conservation groups and maybe this hasn't been brought to your group or your regional manager or your local manager hasn't mentioned that and hasn't sort of embraced this concept, I would encourage them to call us because it's something we're excited to partner with those local events and help kind of, you know, create a win-win for everybody.
Awesome. That's amazing. Cool. Well, thanks again for the time today, Brandon.
No, appreciate the opportunity. And if questions come up, just let me know.
Well, that's a wrap, guys. I hope you enjoyed that conversation and learned from it. Again, there's numerous links in the show description to check out for many of the things we mentioned in this conversation. Thank you always for tuning in and sharing your support to the show. And if you haven't already, be sure to hit subscribe or follow in your podcast app so that you receive future episodes automatically. And we'll talk to you soon.